Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. Joining me today is David Mears, who's the executive director of Audubon Vermont. We're going to be talking, obviously, about Audubon Vermont and the Green Mountain Audubon Center. David, welcome.
Thank you.
It's been a while, but it's good to see you.
Same.
Yeah, we go back a few years, don't we?
It has been a while.
No stories. That's part of the deal if you're a guest. But anyway, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your position at Audubon?
Sure. I'm currently the executive director at Audubon Vermont, which is the state office of the National Audubon Society. And my background, I have a nomadic career, but I'm an environmental lawyer. I went to Vermont Law School and then wandered around the country working in a variety of different public sector jobs in Texas, Washington State, and even Washington, D.C. But I came back to Vermont to work with Vermont Law School and then also had a short stint with the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation before joining Audubon.
Great. I guess I must have met you in that short stint, you know? Yes, because David is very good at management. What did we call it back then? I can't remember. We used to do
We had a whole – at the department, we had this wonderful program called Lean.
Lean. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you came on with my sister who was in charge of it statewide. So anyway, could you talk a little bit about Audubon Vermont, what it is?
Sure. It's – you know, I'll say our mission. Our kind of mission is to protect birds and the places birds need to thrive. And the tools we bring to do that are we do a kind of a three, think of a three-legged stool. We have education and outreach for all ages across all generations. Mm-hmm. We also have on-the-ground conservation work that we do, working with landowners, farmers, forest landowners, public landowners, land trusts and the like to help them manage the land in ways that are good for birds and bird habitat. And by the way, it turns out that when you take care of the birds, it also is the same things that people and all critters need.
Great.
And then the third leg of the stool is advocacy and public policy work. I've spent a fair amount of time with our friends at the Vermont Legislature.
Oh, yes. We know them well. They'll be back soon. There you go. It's going to be a whole different year this year with so many new legislators. I don't know if you go up there, but you're going to have to educate a few of the new ones. Everybody's busy trying to figure out how to do that.
No, I know. Yeah. Yeah, we've got a lot of new faces to meet. And, you know, another thing for – this won't maybe mean as much to folks who don't spend a lot of time at the legislature. But as you know, the key players at the General Assembly are the committee chairs.
Right.
And there's also a significant turnover in committee chairs.
Right.
So there will be a lot of change this coming session.
Can be a big learning curve for them. I hope they're up for it. That's good. Anyway, David, after you were named executive director, this is a long quote, but you were quoted as saying, "The work of protecting our wild places from our mountains to our rivers while ensuring the continued ecological health and vitality of our working forests and fields has never been more important for birds and all species, including humans." And that was back 2018, was that when you? I bet it's true today, if not more so.
Absolutely right. No, it's true. I mean, certainly global climate change hasn't gone away. The pressures of development, if anything, have increased. You know, as we've saw a significant influx of people moving here to escape the pandemic, knowing that Vermont was a place that was handling it fairly well, we had a lot of people move here. And as more people want to buy their little, you know, 10 acres of paradise, it's that much more pressure on our landscape. So the environmental pressures have increased. At the same time, I think one of the things that happened in the last few years that's exciting from the standpoint of, you know, for all of us who want to protect Vermont's hills and silver waters is that people spent more time outside during the pandemic. And I think more Vermonters than ever realized how important that connection is. It was kind of astonishing to us, the number of people using more trails across the state, including at the Green Mountain Audubon Center.
Right. That's very true. I actually spent, which is unheard of for me, but I actually spent a lot of time out because you felt safer outside and you didn't have to wear a mask.
Exactly.
And here you go. So I read where Audubon focuses on bird species protection in the areas, and you mentioned climate, working lands, water, and bird-friendly communities. Can you talk about these areas, particularly bird-friendly communities? Love that phrase.
Yeah, the idea is that, first of all, there's emerging science that shows that migratory birds, they absolutely need large blocks of habitat, large areas of forests and, you know, wetlands and floodplains and all those things that, you know, when you think of wildlife, you think of. But it also turns out that the habitat in our backyards, in our communities and our local parks and schoolyards and all those places are also vital habitat for migratory birds. And so getting communities at the level of people who are homeowners or live in a condominium complex or are involved in local government or thinking about greening up the library space, you know, the grounds around the library or the schoolyards, all of those places are really critical to the health of birds. So the Bird Friendly Communities program is intended to provide resources and information to ordinary folks. Turns out if you plant native plants in your backyard, you'll start seeing more unusual and interesting birds.
Yeah, I think that's cool. We're going to talk about that a little bit later, about how to plant for birds.
Yes.
Something's on my lawn, though, David. They come in droves. I don't know what's on my backyard, but something's in the soil somewhere. As executive director, you also coordinate policy work about the areas we just talked about. How do you go about identifying what policies need to be developed and implemented? I mean, what kind of research do you do?
Well, we start with the science, and one of the joys of being at the Audubon is that we have this really rich human resource in terms of scientists who are – that know how to talk to researchers. They don't do the research, but they know how to understand and interpret all the science that's out there and then translate it into action on the ground. So, you know, if we're working with a farmer and they want to know – what are the kinds of plants or what are the kinds of practices that we can apply that will be important for birds? We can take the science and apply that. And the science also at the national level, there's some amazing new information. You know, I know you were talking earlier about the Migratory Bird Explorer.
Right.
There's these tools that are being developed at a national, even global level that are taking advantage of new technologies and satellite communication.
Things right on your app, right on your phone, right? That
exactly.
You can track these birds.
Exactly.
I think that's fascinating. I'd love to look into that a little bit more. Because, you know, we were talking about Audubon, and I think one time you were on my TV show, and I brought in an Audubon book I had from I don't know how old it was. But that's what most of us think about Audubon, about the Audubon Guide, the John H. Audubon Birds of America, and the Field Guide. There are just so many Audubon books with incredible pictures. But Audubon is a whole lot more than that, as you've been alluding to. And you've got an amazing staff, by the way, that must really help you a lot.
I'm very proud of the team that we have, most of whom were there before I arrived and have committed their careers to protecting birds and bird habitat in Vermont. But, you know, you were asking about policy, and so I start with science. And the other piece of it is, so figuring out what are the greatest threats to birds. And then start from there, and then bringing in legislators and public elected officials. I mean, one of the things about Vermont is that our elected officials are very close to their communities. So finding that kind of, if you think of one of those, you know, what are those drawings called? Venn diagrams, you know, where there's different circles that overlap. The perfect policy initiatives are those that are based in science, dealing with the greatest threats to birds, but that also respond to the community needs.
Right.
And so I love talking with local legislators and with the governor's office and the Agency of Natural Resources, because they're very much in touch with Vermont communities and know the kinds of challenges that Vermonters are dealing with.
Is Act 250 something you follow a lot? Because they've been trying to change Act 250 or amend it or tweak it for like years, and they haven't exactly progressed too far.
No,
it's weird.
As you know, it's one of those topics that Vermonters love to fight about.
Yeah, well, you know, just the name Act 250 and your shackles go up a little bit, but I'm sure there's a whole lot in there that would impact what you do.
It's true. I mean, if I were to try to describe the kind of the primary policy goals that we have at Audubon, they all relate in some way to protecting the land.
Right.
And the model of the way that when folks think of New England, which, you know, we've lost a lot of the patterns of development in New England in some places that have really become heavily suburbanized around Boston. But Vermont still represents that kind of idyllic village or town center surrounded by farms and forests, set nestled within green hills with clean water running through it. That landscape is our greatest asset. It's our greatest, kind of, for our quality of life, our prosperity, but also for birds.
Right.
If you protect that landscape, you're kind of taking care of birds and wildlife. It's good climate policy. It's good for clean water. All of those things add up. And, you know, given that the tourism recreation sector of our economy is such a big part of our economy, right, it also is good for that.
Right.
So it checks a lot of boxes to kind of find that area of overlap in our public policies.
That's great. So you were just talking before about all of your programs from preschool to high school. Could you talk a little bit about them? Because I bet the kids must love going to your programs.
I just have to say, it's one of the great delights. I've never worked at an office before where I'm surrounded by kids. And it's such a delight to be in my office and a group of, you know, 5-year-olds run by howling like coyotes or flapping their wings like crows. Yeah, we have a whole set of programs. We have programs that run from we have a free play school program for both the kids and their caregivers, their parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles to come by just to be able to spend time outside in a semi-structured way with one of our educators. But we also have preschool programs, and we have programs that all the way up through high school, college, and then adult programming.
Yes, us grown-ups, we need a little educating, too. I have to talk to you about this owl that's in my backyard. That darn thing is so loud. And my dog, who hears it in the house, gets just berserk because he hears this owl. Anyway, we have Forbes from East Corinth on the phone. Forbes, you have a question for Dave?
Yeah, as you travel out on rural ponds and things like that, you see nesting platforms or housing all over the place. Who's responsible for all? Who does all that? And also, the second part would be loons and bats. Of course, bats aren't a bird, but are they doing anything in the preservation of that?
Sure. There's different kinds of platforms, but the most common one are for the common loons that have been set up on lakes and ponds. And there's a group called Vermont Center for Eco Studies that works very closely with the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department to kind of create funding and support. And oftentimes local lake and pond associations will play an important role in both setting up the platforms and then keeping boaters and recreationists away from them. But in Vermont, as is so often true, there's this really rich network of organizations that work all together on a whole variety of different bird conservation activities.
Right.
On bats, the lead organization has been, again, the Department of Fish and Wildlife in Vermont. They have a really active wildlife protection program and some amazing biologists that are working on some cutting edge efforts to research and understand the risks to bats.
Not my favorite creature, by the way. But anyway, Forbes, thank you for the question. And I was going to ask Dave if he has some stories about children that he could share with us, because I bet you see them all the time.
I do. I do. I describe the joy of seeing the kids run by howling like coyotes. It really is amazing, and particularly in the summertime when the summer camp programs are going on and there's kids everywhere down by the river, running up through the hills, playing in the education barn. There's just so much happening. There was a time I was wandering down by the beaver pond, and just the sheer joy of kids lifting up rocks and discovering bugs and salamanders.
Oh, yuck.
It's just, it reminds you that there really is this incredible joy in the discovery of nature that we can all experience. The other thing I really appreciate is, I periodically ask some middle schoolers the other day, for input on a policy issue. And there's something about like the clarity of thinking of young people that I find really refreshing, and it restores my faith. Like, we have to depend on this generation to fix all the issues all the messes we've left behind.
They pretty cut down to the core, don't they? They just, in a couple of words, they get right to the point.
Exactly.
It's great. Good for you. So, I would encourage, you've got an amazing website, and I would encourage our listeners, if you could give them your website address, which I'm assuming you know, let them know and check this out, seriously.
Yeah, it's simple. It's the www.audubonvt.com. www.ITSA.org.
There you go, folks. It is amazing. And their events calendar is, I didn't know what to pick because I wanted to talk to you about some of the events and it went on forever. And I said, well, I can't ask. We'll be here all day. Oh, that reminds me. If you want to talk to Dave, here's the number, 244-1777. Sorry, I always forget to tell you that. So you have a program called Women Who Bird Stick Season, which I think is what we're in now.
It's true. Yeah, no, it's coming up, and we have a great number of really amazing birders at our office. I mean, one of the things that's been a joy for me, just I'll talk about the program, but has been be surrounded by both people that are really knowledgeable about nature and about birds and wildlife, and who are good at communicating it. Mm. You know, someone could have a PhD or six PhDs in ornithology and not really be able to connect. But my team are really good at getting people in the woods and feeling comfortable. So the Women Who Bird is an example of that for folks who feel more comfortable being out with a group of women or just enjoy the, you know, the joy of sisterhood and being outdoors.
You don't have to know much, do you? You can tag along and they'll help you understand, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. The whole point is to learn. Feel comfortable and learn. And it is amazing, you know, like in theory, any of us can identify birds. But the, you know, I thought, you know, there were robins and cardinals and blue jays and chickadees. I could see them. They're very visible. But it turns out if you learn where to look and how to listen, most importantly, how to listen, you can start to figure out what kinds of habitat you might expect to see a bird, and whether it's on the ground or in the midstory or on the top of the trees, if it's in a piney woods or it's maple forest or it's a wetlands. Like all these things make a difference in terms of what kinds of birds you'd expect to see and hear.
That's what you mentioned about up top. We have a blue heron that comes on his way south and on his way back. I don't know where he lives, but every year the neighbors have a pond right in their backyard, which is our view. We can see this pond and there's all sorts of bear and deer and birds all over us. But this blue heron every year on his trip stops at our pond and I get the biggest kick out of it because he goes to the highest tree and that's where he'll stay and rest for a few days and then goes off to wherever. It's so cool. It's just great. So one of the other programs, which I think is great, you have quite a few of these, the Pride Hikes for the LGBTQIA plus community. That's great. And you do it at Shelburne Farms or all different places?
All different places. Yeah. Every month it shifts around. It's
great.
A program that started just a few years ago. And, you know, it's interesting. When I first learned about it, I thought, well, why would you have a special program just for people that are, you know, in the LGBTQ community? And, you know, like everyone's welcome to go outside.
Right.
And as for women or as for people of color or people in the LGBTQ community, you start to realize that not everyone feels as safe as I do as a white guy, you know, going out in the woods. And so creating spaces where people feel really welcome. We've been working with the Pride Center and other organizations to kind of just create this space for people to get outside and
enjoy
nature.
Afraid to ask stupid questions either, maybe in an environment you're comfortable with. That'd be me. Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. You have this thing called Unschool at Audubon, and it's about wilderness survival. That sounds interesting.
Right. That's one of the classes. There's a whole series of classes. And Unschool is kind of organized or oriented towards those families that are doing homeschooling and want to have some opportunity for their kids to get out and work with a, you know, biologist or an expert environmental educator to learn more about the outdoors.
Right.
So it's a wonderful program.
That's great. That wilderness survival, that'll perk you right up.
Yeah.
And you have this, I'm assuming it's a lecture series, the Seward Weber lecture series. And you have guest speakers. And I was reading up about one of your guest speakers, and I didn't write her name down. But it sounds really fascinating.
It's coming up. Yeah, Professor Amy Seidel.
Oh, right,
I think
Amy.
It's the second week in November. It'll be at the Unitarian Church in Montpelier.
Yeah, I actually wrote that down just because.
Yeah, I think it's actually been a few years since we had one of the lectures, but it was named in the honor of Seward Weber, who was a longtime conservation leader in Vermont, who many folks know. And it's sponsored by the Vermont Land Trust, the Vermont Natural Resources Council, and Audubon Vermont. So we should have a really good turnout for folks. And Professor Seidel is a really a fantastic speaker and very knowledgeable about the environmental movement.
I looked up her background just because, and she sounds fascinating. So you don't have this program anymore, but it was on your website from maybe last year, which really got me thinking. It was called Mindfulness and Mental Health, a Community Conversation, and I have done many shows on mental health in Vermont, of which we have a problem. So what is that all about?
Well, that came about because one of our AmeriCorps members, Kira Farrick-Fagan, I think had a personal family, you know, connection to mental health and was trying to connect that to her chosen career in the outdoors, and did some amazing research and began to identify the ways in which being outdoors and connecting to nature can be a really vital part of treatment. And this is not just like a hippie frou-frou, you know, kind of thing. Like the science and the mental health professionals have documented that, you know, like a lot of times for mental health, it's exacerbated by stress and anxiety. Right. One of the greatest ways to deal with that is to be outdoors. It creates space. There's something about being outside in nature.
The sun alone, having vitamin D from the sun helps you with your emotions and feelings.
Exactly.
Right?
Helps you feel calm. Yep. It also can be a really critical way to get exercise, and physical fitness is key to mental health recovery. For substance abuse, you know, anyone who's, you know, either been or had a family member or friend that's a recovering substance abuser knows how difficult withdrawal can be. Mm. And being outdoors can be a space in which you can really practice mindfulness and think about, you know, your connection to the broader world. And not feel so alone, like you're trapped in your room with your own challenges.
Is that something you might think about doing again? Because I think in this day and age, in this state, there are so many people focused on how to deal with mental health. Our law enforcement people, lots of people, just it's everywhere.
That's a great suggestion.
I think Kira's since
left us, but we probably should rethink doing something like that.
Because it might really help a lot of people if you connect with Central Vermont Home Health, not Home Health and Hospice, but Mary Moulton on the center. I can't remember her name of her organization. She's going to kill me. Washington County Mental Health. I got it. It's there. Thank God. My husband says I'm not losing my mind. It's just got too much stuff in there. But anyway, I would think they would welcome that kind of opportunity to bring some of their clients out in the.
That's a great suggestion.
Writing it down. This is cool. Anyway, I have on my notes here that you already talked about the Bird Migration Explorer, but could you talk about how, you know what, David, I'm going to hold up on that question and we'll come back to ask about that because we've got to take a break. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Hi there, it's Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint, here with David Mears, who's the executive director of the Audubon Vermont. And we were just going to talk about the Bird Migration Explorer before we went to break. And that's something I can put on my app. How does that work and where does one get it?
Yeah, well, if you go to the National Audubon Society website and just type in Migratory Bird Explorer, it'll pop up. In fact, it's probably on the homepage right now because we just released it. And
oh, great.
So it'll pop right up. And it's a really fun online system. In fact, you could spend days just immersed in trying to explore it. You can look at specific locations that you're interested in, or you can identify a bird you're interested in. And what it does is it's that fundamentally what it's about is showing all the places that birds go. And it takes all this data from birders who put it into kind of applications like something called eBird or researchers, anybody who's tracking birds. There's satellite. They can put little satellite tags, these little microchips on birds, and follow them as they migrate from Vermont.
Wow.
To Mexico or Central America or even South America, like our bobolinks go all the way to Argentina. Think about that. From Argentina to Vermont. So Migratory Bird Explorer, you can look at this application on site and it will show you where those birds go, where actual specific Vermont birds go to spend the winter.
Cool.
And I mean, that's just cool in and of itself, but it's also important because it reveals some really important information. Like one of the things we know now is that the northern forests that Vermont is part of have some of the richest diversity in the world of migratory songbirds. And so all those birds that come here, the wood thrush, the hermit thrush, the indigo bunting, you know, like these, all these amazing, beautiful birds, scarlet tanagers, they need 90% of the, some species, like the thrush species, like bigmouth thrush or wood thrush, depend upon the northern forest for their survival. So the work we do to protect forests in Vermont is critical to the survival of these species across the whole globe. And you also can see where, because we're part of the National Audubon Society, we can look at other places across the country and even into South and Central America where there's key places to look at that need protection.
I could find where my buddy the blue heron comes and goes.
Absolutely.
I would love to know. David was also telling me that my owl that I talked about before, that if I put his sound on there's an app that would tell me what kind of owl it was.
Yes. If you haven't.
Now I'm doing that.
If your viewers, or I mean listeners, haven't discovered this already, there's something called Merlin, like Merlin the wizard.
Right.
That you can get from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And if you download that app on your phone, it'll show you how to record the sound of the bird, and then it will tell you immediately
what
kind of bird it is.
Got to tell my dog to slow down. It's just you thought it was a bard?
I think it's probably a bard owl, yes.
Okay, great. Anyway, as I was saying, you've got to check out the website. They've got a news section, and I picked out a couple of things there that I found fascinating. One was coordinating care, the poison parsnip problem. What is that, David?
Well, it's first of all,
it doesn't sound good.
No, the parsnip is one of those invasive weeds that is a real problem in Vermont. But first, a quick shout out to Thomas Patty, who is the author of that.
Mm.
One of the programs that we have that I'd love to talk about if we have a moment is our youth leadership program. We bring in these amazing young adults to come in and work with us as interns on conservation or policy. And Thomas did a lot of work with our conservation team, Margaret Fowle and Mark Labar and others, on bobolink and grassland protection. So he wrote these great articles about bobolinks, which depend on grasslands. And one of the threats to Vermont's grasslands are invasive species. And one of the most insidious of those species is this poison parsnip, or wild parsnip. And it's an invasive species. It wasn't naturally here. And it's kind of it looks almost like Queen Anne's lace, but it's yellow at the top. Kind of those multiple florets of yellow flowers. And it's very common, particularly in Chittenden County. In the summers now, you'll see it in late summer. It's yellow and it's spreading everywhere.
Hmm.
And it's toxic to, it's not good for cattle to eat. It kind of destroys fields. And I discovered the hard way. I'll roll up my sleeve here and show you some of my scars.
David, his arms are a little scarred.
I foolishly went out and harvested a bunch with my T-shirt on because the sap.
You should know better, David.
I should have known. my staff were so disappointed to me. But if you get the sap on you while you're in the sun,
it burns.
It burns.
Whoa.
So it's and one of the best ways to control it is simply to mow it. If you mow it before the seed heads form,
it won't grow.
You can stop it from spreading.
Now, who is it? You said cattle. Is it dogs and birds, or what's it poisonous to?
It would be won't eat. They just won't eat it.
Yeah.
It just kind of what it does is it crowds out all the other grasses and things that the animals
do. So they have nothing to eat.
They have nothing to eat.
Oh,
so
great.
That's why we need to control it.
All right. So tell me about this one on your website on the news. It said bird friendly maple and coffee. That sounds very intriguing.
It is fun. One of the people ask, what's the difference between ordinary maple and bird friendly maple? And in many cases, there's no difference. It depends on the forest. If a maple sugar operation owner manages their forest where they have lots of different species of maple trees and they allow for different structures and shrubs and they allow for the trees to fall down, all those things which aren't neat. You know, the classic maple sugar bush from a century ago was very neat. There was nothing but maple sugar trees. That's not great for habitat.
Right.
But if you allow lots of different species, it's actually better for the maple sugar trees, sugar maple trees, and it's certainly better for birds. So we have a set of criteria that if you're producing maple sugar and you get your sugar from trees that are managed in this way, to create bird habitat, then you get to have a sticker that says bird friendly maple on it.
Oh.
And so there's actually a company that is headquartered out of Vermont that also distributes bird friendly coffee, which of course is not grown in Vermont, but it's grown in in Central America on plantations that are managed in ways that are same idea. Instead of having just a desert, or a monoculture of just coffee trees, but you have the ability for coffee bushes to grow in the shade and surrounded by other kinds of habitat. It's better for birds. So we partnered with them and said,
cool.
Let's market our products together.
So if we buy and look for bird-friendly maple and bird-friendly coffee, we're helping the environment and the birds?
Absolutely.
I love it. Remember that, people. That's because I actually didn't read it that way. I read it bird-friendly maple and coffee. But I didn't realize till you just said that there's bird-friendly coffee.
Yes.
Excellent. Got to learn stuff every day. That's so cool. I also saw on your website, and I'm going to put a shout-out to Senator Leahy, who's apparently has a very strong conservation legacy. Good for him.
He does. There was a really amazing event that the Vermont Natural Resources Council and a few other organizations came together to put on a few weeks back up in Shelburne.
Yeah, the League of Cities and Towns was part of that. I had Ted Brady on talking about it.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
Well, and I know there's been multiple kinds of events for Senator Leahy, but it really is when I think Candy Page and Gay Symington and one of Senator Leahy's former staffers, Maggie Gendron, who's now at the Institute of Natural Resources, all just spoke. And when you hear of course, he's been in that office for so many years.
Right.
When you add up all the different ways in which he's, been responsible for appropriations or public policies that have made a difference for Vermont's habitat, it's quite amazing.
I wish we knew more about our congressmen and what they do beyond the bills, because I was down at Cedar Creek. Senator Benning was down there putting up a plaque from Vermont, and they mentioned Senator Jeffords and how much he supported Cedar Creek, and I didn't know it. And I'm sorry I don't know that. Shame on me. And I don't know how you know it unless their staff
communicates
it. But because I love all of our congressmen, their staff has always been over the years just the best. And if you call up with a constituent problem, they are right there to help. But I digress anyway. One other thing which I love, because the peregrine falcon, making sense of the peregrine falcon's variable migration patterns. I was in motor vehicles when we put out the peregrine falcon plate, so I like the peregrine falcon. It's so cool.
Well, it is super cool, and it has largely recovered to what it was pre. It was one of those raptors, one of those birds of prey that was largely wiped out because of DDT in Vermont. And to restore it, actually, they had to get different varieties of peregrine falcons from other parts of, the country where it hadn't been wiped out. And as a result, we have a mix of different genetic backgrounds for peregrine falcons. So the article kind of describes, because of that genetic mix, and the genetics in some ways determine where the birds go in the winter, some migrate south and some migrate only a little bit south, and some seem to stay put. So there's this interesting migratory patterns that are
nice.
You wouldn't expect to see, but it's a result of the ways in which we restored the population.
The ones I've seen are usually up on rocks, high up on rocks, and they nest in the crevices of rocks. Isn't that?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's correct. You should have seen the artist's rendition of the peregrine falcon that was supposed to be, because it's a bird of prey, and this thing was serious. It was just beautiful, but they could never get it quite right on the plate. It just never translated correctly. But the original painting was just stunning. You should find that and put it in the Audubon. That would be great to dig through the archives there and find it.
Right.
It was amazing. Anyway, you also talk about what you call priority birds. I'm assuming birds that are, I figured you have endangered birds and then a priority bird, which means you maybe move birds from the endangered species up to priority. Is that how they sort of get on one or the other list? Is that there, he's shaking his head like what?
No. It's a
what is she talking about?
It's a great question, and it is kind of confusing. There's this kind of a legal structure around the ideas of what are threatened and endangered species, both in state law and federal law.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the birds that are on those lists are also considered priority birds for Audubon Vermont.
Huh.
What makes them priority for us is whether or not it's a priority to protect their habitat. And when you think about in the medical field, they have triage, right?
Mm-hmm.
You pick, you're gonna, if someone's hurt, but they're gonna make it without
right.
help. They're low priority. Or if they're so far gone, you're just gonna lose them.
Right.
You want to focus your time and energy on the people, the health issues mm-hmm. you can fix. Same for birds. So our priority birds include some birds that are not threatened or endangered, but they really like the blue black-throated blue warbler is mm-hmm. one that depends. Like Vermont's forests are at the center of its kind of habitat. It's critical that we protect the habitat needs for the black-throated blue warbler. So it's a priority bird for us, even though it's not in Vermont endangered or threatened.
Excellent. And we have Nola from Ripton on the phone. Nola, you have a question for David?
Actually, I have a short, amazing Robert Frost poem for all of you.
Oh, excellent.
Mr. Frost loved the birds, especially the birds of Vermont, and he's written a zillion poems about them. This one is short, but it speaks of that sense of wonder with children and animals.
Nice.
Okay, so don't fall asleep. Don't hang up. It's a beautiful poem. It's called Questioning Faces. The winter owl banked just in time to pass and save herself from breaking window glass and her wings draining, suddenly a spread caught color from the last of evening red in a display of underdown and quill to glassed-in children at the windowsill.
Oh, nice. Thank you. You read it beautifully, too. Thank you very much.
I didn't read it. I have it in my notes.
Oh, do you? Now I'm even more impressed. Thank you very much, Nola. Thank you for calling in. We have Fred from Newberry on the phone. Fred, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I guess I'm pretty good.
Good.
For an old time, huh?
Exactly.
My question is, as far as songbirds are concerned, which is the greatest threat, a clear and present threat for songbirds? House cats or climate change?
David shaking his head. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think I don't know that I could. It depends on which bird we're talking about. But the two greatest threats right now to birds are climate change and loss of habitat.
Hmm.
And the two things are related in that some of the habitat we're losing is a result of the changes in climate. But also there's a fair amount of habitat loss happening just because of unmanaged or unstrategic development, putting subdivisions or
– Yeah, no trees, no nothing. They just go in and knock them all down.
Exactly. So so those are the two greatest threats. But climate change is right up there at the top.
Great. Thanks. That's a very good question, Fred. Thank you. I want to spend the remaining time talking about the Green Mountain Audubon Center. And by the way, there are 255 acres that are run and owned by Audubon, and you're free to walk all over them. So yes. Check it out.
Please do. It's been amazing. We've had, during the pandemic, there was record use of our trails. And as a result, we created actually a volunteer trail maintenance
great
crew so that folks would be able to continue to enjoy them. And the community of Huntington, Hinesburg, Richmond, a lot of the folks in the area, just wonderfully kind in terms of helping us keep those spaces up and up to snuff. So it's a lovely spot. We have – it's trails along the river, up into the hills, along the forest level. And we have adult programming too. So if you're part of a group, whether it's Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts or – a local retirement community, high school field trips. We're happy to work with you to organize, structured educational programs.
And the center itself, it's something where you can go in and you've got a management goal, a plan that goes on forever and your website, and it's fascinating. I wish we had more time. You should come back another time to talk about it. What can people see in the center?
Well, the center itself is inside. There's not much, honestly. We have an education barn. I mean, we have this wonderful neighbor, the Birds of Vermont Museum, which is just a little further up the road, which if you haven't been, I strongly encourage you to go. It's full of bird carvings of virtually every bird that, lives in Vermont for some stage of its life. There's a carving of it up at the Birds of Vermont Museum, and they also have their trails also connect to ours.
My dad used to carve birds before he passed away, and we had these little cups around the house of eyes and feet and beaks. and I have my house is full of birds.
Oh, that's
it's
fun.
It's just great. So I grew up with birds, and knew what they would do. They would a friend of his was well known for bird carving, and she would find dead birds and then would put them in the freezer and then use them as a model for her birds, because she'd have them frozen there and be able to study the wings and sort of things. So I grew up with all those. That's great. So this management plan that you have, is that something you created or National Audubon? Or because it seriously, I don't think you've left one stone unturned. This thing goes on forever, and it's fascinating.
Well, it's a chance for us to show that the ways in which you can manage the landscape that are good for birds and habitat, including one section of it, we have an active forest management plan where we have harvested timber. And, you know, there's this debate that plays out in the public about whether cutting trees is bad. Hmm. Well, in Vermont, we have forests that are really quite even-aged. That is the state was largely cleared. We were 80% cleared, just 100 years ago.
Hmm.
So all of the trees that have grown back are all in the 80 to 120-year range, which is like a teenage years in forest, and they're all the same. It's not good habitat. What birds and wildlife really need is a mix of open spaces in the forest. So we've set up a whole forest management plan to demonstrate, and we do training programs for loggers and foresters and forest landowners to show them the ways in which you can harvest trees, make a little money from selling the trees, help pay your property tax, but also keep it in forest. Because the two most vital things are keeping the forest as forest and then managing them actively so that they continue to have the characteristics of what we want to see in a healthy forest.
That's great. There's that song about paving paradise.
Yes.
Every time you're talking about it, that song keeps going in my head. How dumb are we, right?
Exactly.
Let's pave paradise. You talk about important bird areas in Vermont. What are those and where are those, more importantly?
Yeah, it's in some ways it's connected to the idea of priority birds. The scientists will look at which are the priority bird species and what are the categories of habitat that they most need. And it won't surprise anybody that in Vermont, the most precious habitat that we have are our forests. So when you look at the central Vermont, the spine of the Green Mountains, those are some of the most important bird areas that we have. So you'll see that. Other areas that may not necessarily be marked as important bird areas but are also critical are places like our National Wildlife Refuges, the Missisiskoi up on Lake Champlain, or over in the Conti National Wildlife Refuge. There's just a variety of places in which we have these amazing.
Where is that, David? I've never heard of it. What is it?
The Conti?
Yeah,
the Conti National Wildlife Refuge is unique of wildlife refuges. It includes the whole Connecticut River watershed. But instead of being just one location, it's a mix of different locations. And in Vermont, there's an area up in what they call the Nulhegan that's a beautiful swath of what they call boreal forest that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the state and local landowners are all working together to manage to kind of restore and recover the wildlife habitat there.
David, I have enjoyed this conversation so much. I have to have you come back because I've got pages of questions still left. But you mentioned when we last talked that how we can help, and you said you can raise your voices to lawmakers, find your bird-friendly plants, and I would encourage you to go on the website and find what plants to grow in your backyard and support your events. I got those from the last time we talked. If there's more, please jump right in, because you need some help sponsorship. I'm sure contributions are welcome.
Very welcome, yes.
I bet. We got about 2 minutes. Anything less you'd like to encourage people to do?
No, I do want to say, we're coming right up on election. Get out and vote.
Right.
Vote for those candidates you think they're going to do the most important work for protecting Vermont's habitat.
Yes, exactly, because that's one thing we are known for all over the United States. our beauty and our landscapes. You even mentioned this, some words from the state song there a little while ago.
Exactly.
Anyway, thank you all very much for listening in. Stay tuned. I have Suzanne Butterfield, who is a tour guide in New England and a good friend, and she's going to talk to us about touring New England. David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Pat Mears,
Executive Director for the Audubon Vermont. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint from WDEV. Hi there. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. We're back with our second hour. And my guest today is Suzanne Butterfield, who is a guide for Custom Tours, Inc., and we're going to talk about touring New England and Canada by motor coach. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, this is great. Suzanne and I have known each other for a while.
Ages.
Yeah. Let's not say that. Anyway, Suzanne's a tour guide, as I said, for Custom Tours since 2000. And Suzanne says that it's the best job ever. Could you tell us why?
Well, it's the most fun. If you like people, if you're a people person and you're into history and you like to show things off like your home state, it's lots of fun. It's way more fun than politics. It's way more fun than sales. But actually, it is sales in a way because we're selling our territory, our area, the Northeast.
Right.
And so I work with Custom Tours and more. And somebody told me, they said, yeah, you're the and more. I said, well, good, bad, or indifferent. But it is, it's a fun job.
Well, the reason I thought about Suzanne, I've always wanted to have her come on. When I was running for the Senate a couple of years ago, I'm standing in Waitsfield waving to passing by cars. And these two gorgeous, solid white buses come by and they slow down and there's a woman in the bus waving her arms to like crazy, and it's Suzanne, and she had everybody on the bus cheering me on, which I thought, well, that's cool.
That's right.
So thank you for that.
They were probably from Ohio, but they, you know, they would have voted for you.
Said, that's funny.
We like that lady. She has an honest face.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that was just too funny when I saw that. I'm like, what is
going about that?
What? Oh my God, I didn't. She go, what? And they're slowing down. I'm like, what the heck? Am I doing something wrong? But no, there was Suzanne waving away. So talk a little bit about Custom Tours, because they have been recognized as a leader in the industry, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about them.
Sure. Well, Custom Tours and More is what is known as a receptive tour operator, which means we're the ones who help set up the interview, set up the everything that they're going to do while they're here in Vermont or New England.
Right.
So if you're a tour operator, say in Indiana, and you're coming here with your own motor coach, what we call buses,
right,
you need someone to help set up the hotels and the attractions and meals and pretty much your whole itinerary.
Yeah. Now you, and again, if you want to check out their website, it's really interesting. You say that each tour is custom, and I was struggling with that because under the states that you deal with, you've got maybe 10, 15 sites listed under each one of those states, and there's just no way one can cover all of those. So how do you make it custom for anybody that wants to come?
Right. Well, they have a choice of, let's say the tour operator from Indiana wants to do Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
They probably have an idea of what their travelers would like to see, and we just kind of hone it to options. You could do this, or the other thing. And because we're here and they're there, they really need us
to help
finalize everything.
That's great. What do your customers usually look for in a tour? Obviously, the itinerary is probably the most important, but I bet there's a few other things that they would like to see and have.
Well, they want places with good food.
That's my list,
yes.
Suzanne.
They also want options, and most of the hotels and inns serve a breakfast. So, so when they set off for their day, they've had breakfast in most cases. And then lunch would either be on their own somewhere, like here we are in Waterbury. There's several lunch options around here that we've used over the years. Or maybe an organized luncheon, something special like the Trapp Family Lodge.
Mm.
And then dinner maybe on their own. So we try to give them a balance so that a lot of them are seniors and they say, well, it's too much food because they've had a big breakfast. They've had maybe lunch on their own and then an organized dinner And we know where those places are, as do most people that are in the tour business.
That's
thanks
right.
to the Tourism Department and the Chamber of Commerce, we've got probably the same list that a lot of the tour operators have, but they're not here, and we are.
That's great. So what do your tours include? There's a laundry list from meeting them at the airport and...
Yes. Yeah. That's a good statement. If they're from away, like California, they fly into one of several different airports, and then we would have a coach meet them at the airport. But if they're coming with their own motor coach, then they're, you know, may take them, like my group from Alabama. It took them 2 days to get here. They wound up staying up in Jay Peak. So it was a 9-day trip because the 2 days on either end just to get to Vermont.
I hope they hit Peak. Because Peak this year was early and quick.
Yes, it was fabulous. Yeah. And people were saying, oh, it won't be any good because it's been dry, but it was wonderful. But I'm thinking of that group from Alabama, whom I still keep in touch with. They got to see a moose as we were going back the hotel at the end of the day. There was a moose running alongside the motor coach.
Oh, you're kidding. They must have freaked out. That's great.
The bus just about tipped over on that side because everyone wanted to go there with
That's
their camera.
Great.
Oh, it was wonderful. So he started out running and then trotted and then walked. I think we were tiring the moose out. The bus driver said, what do I do? I said, just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, don't swerve. Don't do anything.
And then he veered off onto the moose veered off onto a side road.
That's good. So you were talking about how do you pick a state or location? Say you want to add Connecticut. I don't think that's on your list. I mean,
Mystic Seaport.
Because you have to change your website.
Okay.
But say you pick Connecticut. I mean, how you go there and how do you pick what to offer people?
Well, we use something called the CVB and DMO, Convention Visitors Bureau, and the Destination Marketing Organizations. Mm-hmm. Every state has one. And we usually know the people in our own New England area.
Right.
So we can just plug into somebody that we know to find out what's different on the agenda that we could offer our tour client. We have something called familiarization tours, or we did until COVID struck.
Right.
And that is where they would trot out all of their hotels and attractions and places to see and go and have people who are in the tour business go and look for something new, something different, something that we've never had before on our itinerary.
Now, do you have mostly individual people like myself? I would want to go on a tour. Or do you have groups, Rotary, or whoever comes to mind?
That's a good question. We have it's groups. It's all usually preformed groups that our tour client has. Now, some of them do newsletters where they are sending out 2 years in advance where they're going to be going in, say, 2024 or 2025.
Nice.
They do that all ahead of time, and you know, they offer and they see what sells on their end.
My mom had some friends that were involved in the senior group, and they used to go on tours a lot. Because I would think of an individual getting on a bus with, 60 people?
53, 54.
It must be hard to sort of break the ice, and although maybe it doesn't take too long once you go out for dinner and get to know everybody.
Long.
It doesn't take long. Yeah.
No, they're only a stranger once. But a lot of them travel together. I'm thinking of one group that we have from New Jersey, and it's the same people all the time. They're friends.
Oh, great.
And it's not a senior center. It's just that this client is so active that he'll sell out a tour wherever they're going. They just got back from Sicily.
Oh, excellent.
So they do out of the country as well. But they love New England. They love coming here for, like, the Christmas time and fall foliage. And,
every
other year.
You mentioned a tour was nine days. That's not average, though, is it?
No,
it's usually shorter than that.
Much shorter. It's just that they had a lot of traveling to cover.
Because what are they, maybe 2-3 days? Or?
2-4 days, depending on how far they have to travel and how long they want to be here, how many states they want to cover. A lot of people do New Hampshire and Vermont. Wow. I had one group recently that did just Vermont.
Oh, interesting. Well, I'm just looking at the state, and maybe if they had Connecticut now, you've got Vermont, Rhode Island, New York, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Maine, and Canada. And you said you were trying to expand a little bit into Canada. Is that true?
Well, we've done Canada since day one. Eastern Canada.
Eastern Canada.
And the Maritimes. Right. We'll do like the Tulip Festival in Ottawa. And in fact, I had the privilege of going to a couple of FAM tours, the familiarization tours, where they bring you up there. One of them was Winterfest.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yes,
up there.
And we were in Outaouais, you know, which is the native tongue for Ottawa. And we go all the way out to Cape Breton, Nova Scotia.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Well, that's beautiful up there, Cape Breton. That's great. So, all right, listen to this. What's the most popular state, Suzanne? I'm going to hold you to this. Which one do they ask to go to most? Put you on the.
Well, of course,
you can be honest.
I'm going to say Vermont.
Really?
Yes.
Good
because
for you.
Lots
Good
of
answer.
Times, lots of times they'll come from New Hampshire and they'll be in Vermont and I'll be with them. And they'll say, "Oh, we should have come here first," or "Next time we're coming just here." Or, but all New England. If you look at New England, it's equal to one big state,
right,
as far
that's
as
true.
Landmass goes.
Right.
People don't realize New Hampshire has but 18 miles of seacoast.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're into seacoast and whale watching, you know, it's maybe Maine or Massachusetts, Cape Cod.
Yeah.
And we have contacts in all of those spots, good friends.
Yeah. When you talked about the bus almost turning over with the moose, we were on a whale watching, and there was these whales were breaching, and the whole lot of us went over to one side of the boat, and the captain went running out.
Yeah.
God, don't do that as the boat's tipping. But
it's kind of a fluky story, Pat.
We were doing the same thing. And of course, when we realized what we did, we all moved back quickly.
Yes.
But anyway, in Vermont, I'm going to list this really quick, and I won't do it for all the states because we'll be here all day. In Vermont, you've got covered bridges, obviously the rural routes for scenery, maple sugar houses and sugar on snow, which is seasonal, Trapp Family Lodge, Ben and Jerry's, Rock of Ages, Cabot Cheese, wineries, breweries, yay, and my favorite, farm-to-table dining. Is that something not unique to New England, farm-to-table, or Vermont?
I would say northern New England, although culinary is big, whether you're in you're in Rhode Island or
food is food.
Yes,
yes.
But the good Culinary food. Institute of America over on the Hudson River.
Right.
You know, it depends on what the client wants to see. We can build all of that with a variety into their itinerary. But yes, Vermont has so much to see. I tell people that you could be here for, and this is part of my spiel on the coach. Right. You could be here for an entire month and be out doing what we're doing right now every day, seeing five or six different attractions, and you still wouldn't see it all at the end of that 30 days.
What do you say about our covered bridges when you're touring? Because my husband, you know, we ride motorcycles, and we used to be involved in Americade, and we did covered bridge tours for the Americade people, and they were fascinated by how they're structured and the history behind them.
Yes.
What do you say
about
them?
I know where they all are. I really do. In fact,
the
week before last, I was down in the Bennington area, and they have several. A couple of them you could do it with your motorcycles.
Yeah, right.
But we obviously can't take the bus through there, but you can stop, turn around, like we went to the Norman Rockwell Bridge, we call it, which is in West Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bridge where people can get out, go across the truss bridges, and we know all the statistics when they were built. And
yeah, that's great, and they're so fascinating to people. And we've lost a few over the years because of streams. Suzanne, I've got to stop and take a quick break here. I was just reminded. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Be right back. Hi there, it's Pat McDonald. I'm back with Vermont Viewpoint and with Suzanne Butterfield, tour guide extraordinaire, and we've been gabbing in here a mile a minute in the break time, so we've catching up.
I think I got Pat signed up for something.
Well, we were talking about covered bridges. I'm sure many of you know the two sides of the platform for the bridges are raised from the old days with the wagon wheels, and the horses rode in between, and the wheels were on the side. And when you take a motorcycle in those things, you pick one side and you stay there, otherwise you go down. But you've got some stories about the covered bridges.
Oh, yes, you have to say some funny things once in a while other than the history and the statistics. But I usually joke about the bus driver's first trip to Vermont when he decided he'd take the coach through the covered bridge to give the passengers a thrill. And because they believe it, they think it's a true story. I say, when the police officer came to arrest John, being the quick-thinking bus driver he is, he said, no, officer, I didn't do anything wrong. I was delivering the bridge, and we ran out of fuel. So
There you go.
He got off scot-free.
I bet I'm sure he laughed.
But they do love the covered bridges when they think of Vermont, because some of the states, Indiana, again, a lot of these bridges out in the states out in the Midwest do have covered bridges, but, of course, they're not. Vermont-covered bridges, like the one up in Shelburne Museum that has a sign on it that says there's a $2 fine for not walking your horse or something
Is that right? Oh, I don't think I've seen that one. That's great. Yeah, because there's a book around that Bruce and I have that it's all the covered bridges in sections in the state so that you can take your car and go to each one of them in sections. So you take one Sunday and go down south or whatever.
Great.
So yeah, we've done that. Anyway, so tell me, what do you say about Rock of Ages? Because that's one of my favorite places to bring tourists.
Yes, I love Rock of Ages too. Well, it's the largest deep hole quarry in the world. It's 600 feet.
Now, I didn't even know that.
It used to be it's the oldest, too. It used to be operated by many men, but now with all the hydraulics and everything, they have very few. And, of course, VOSHA is over there, Vermont, for safety and everything. They have very few accidents.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
It's
amazing. Do you take them down to the visitor's platform where they can see the stones being carved and moved around?
Well, we go up to the platform and carefully park the bus, make sure it has really good brakes.
Exactly.
What I do is I walk around listening to the person that is giving us the tour with all the geologic statistics, and I pick up little pieces of granite that are in the shape of Vermont.
Oh.
Wide at the top and narrow at the bottom, just like your
Shirt. Oh, yes, my
So they all leave with a piece of Vermont. I tell them, I say, don't eat it. This is not, this is not candy.
This is not maple candy, right?
No, The granite industry is fantastic, and lots of times we'll accompany that with going up to Mount Hope Cemetery. But everybody's interested in the granite.
Right.
And then we have marble. The western side of
Pittsburgh.
The state. Pittsburgh. Proctor.
Right.
There's a vein of marble that goes down the western part of the state from Canada almost to the Massachusetts border. And it's much softer than granite, so if you're going to make we tell the people if you want countertops, make them out of granite rather than marble.
Right.
And, of course, we have to be careful that the marble doesn't get taken for granite.
The bus joke. There's a in Proctor, there's the bridge.
Yes, the marble bridge. The marble firehouse. Where can you go and see a foundation of a firehouse that's all marble?
Now,
and
I didn't know that. I knew the bridge.
The church on Route 4, that's all marble. And
that's
the sidewalk,
great.
And there's nothing more slippery than a marble sidewalk
for
certain times of the year.
Yeah. Well, I know, and Barry, of course, the granite is Barry Gray. I think that's very unique to Barry and always in high demand.
Right. Yeah. And it was a Scottish, the word quarry and the word grout, those are all Scottish Gaelic terms because it was the Scots that came over here.
Right.
And there's a quarry in that I go by all the time on 89. It's called Bethel White.
Yep.
It looks like marble, but it's not. And that is just about the oldest quarry in the country.
Oh, interesting. Look at all the things that are rattling around in your brain
Ms.
Suzanne.
My father used to call me the head full of nothing because I remember all the unnecessary things.
Oh, this is about Vermont. This is good. Tell me how you display or you talk to people about farm to table. Do you go somewhere where I think it's so amazing going to a restaurant and reading eggs by Fred's Farm down the street and that sort of, I just think it tastes better.
Well, it's an amazing theory. Everything old is new again.
Yeah.
And but once COVID hit, there aren't that many places that do that, farm to table for large groups. But what we will do is, if that's what the tour client and their guests want, we would set up something somewhere special, like maybe not the bottom of the quarry, but Rock of Ages has different places where they
could eat.
Well, not to eat, but you could bring in something, a caterer, say.
Ah, nice.
So there are places that if you really do the sleuthing, I can think of a couple because we don't want to tip our hand too much, but there's a couple in the Windsor County area that I know about.
Enjoy reading the menu where they say where the food comes from. For some reason, it's fresh because it's down the street. And it just seems to taste better because, just by name only because I don't know the farmer, but you feel like you know them. And I think it's a great treat.
It is a great treat, and I've noticed that some of the communities are doing that. I know in Bethel, the White Church has had, not for the, it's for the general public, but not for
right.
tour groups, but it could easily turn
sure.
around to that. But, you know, where it's a community event, and it is farm to table.
Yeah, that's great. I love it.
Several places.
And they have farm to school. They've done a lot of stuff. I have the food bank in here all the time where they do Veggie Van Gogh.
Yes.
And they bring food,
Randolph.
Fresh
mm-hmm.
food right to the kids. I mean, seriously, it's great.
Yeah.
Anyway, the next place you have on is New York City, which of course the list goes on forever. And I've only highlighted a couple of them. Because we would be here for more than an hour. So I know people may like, why is she picking this one? But because some of them, like going to the Statue of Liberty or Ellis Island, that's almost a whole day from the boat ride out
yes.
and back. So I don't know how many things you can squish into one day. But when you take them to Sardi's, which is the toast of Broadway, what do you say about Sardi's? I love Sardi's.
I love, and I can tell you've been there.
Hello, that's
the last time I was there, we ate upstairs.
Ah.
Yeah, because it was a tour
right,
group.
Right.
And of course, the pictures of everybody who's anybody all over the walls. And we did see, I'm trying to think who I saw there, Robert Culp and, different actors were actually there. So
right.
people want to go there because the actors don't want to be pestered, but some of them are pretty good about
signing
an autograph.
Yeah,
because
you're right. There's pictures everywhere that have been autographed, and it was the place to go for,
and it still is,
actually.
Yes, it still is.
It's got a mystique about it that's incredible. I'm a big fan of New York, although maybe not so much recently with all the troubles they're having. But
that would be an organized lunch. That
right.
would be something that would have been part of their itinerary for the day. If it were lunch, then dinner would be on their own somewhere walking
right.
around Broadway. But
yeah.
you can only cram so much into a New York City day. And
right.
you mentioned Ellis Island and
Statue of Liberty.
The Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
That is a big day, and
right.
we go from down below Wall Street to go out there.
Now, they let you walk up to the top now in the Statue of Liberty, or is it still closed?
Mm, no.
No, it's closed?
I talked to somebody the other day, and the furthest they got was up in the arm. I said, you mean the torch?
Because years ago, when I was living in New York, you could go all the way up and then—
To the crown.
To the crown, which
yeah.
was amazing, but they won't allow that anymore
no.
because they're—
no.
afraid.
No. I was there years ago and we couldn't go up that high. My dad was able to go up in the crown back
Well,
in
let's not talk about how old I am then, Suzanne, because I went to the crown. What does that mean? Anyway, we're going to take a break in a few minutes because I want to talk about Radio City Musical.
Oh, yes.
I took that backstage tour.
Yes.
And there is copper everywhere, the pipes and you feel like a midget when you're standing on
I forgot about the pipes.
Oh my gosh, they must have security on that place 24/7.
Yeah, copper's valuable.
Yeah, exactly. But you stand on the stage and you feel like a little ant.
Mm-hmm.
They must love it when you take your tour there.
You know, it's spectacular,
yeah.
really. And we do an organized tour when we go there.
I bet you do because that is huge. And then Lincoln Center is included.
Yes, we go there as well. The museum, the Museum of Fine Arts, the Natural History Museum out by Central Park, and
nice.
By the Dakota.
The Dakota itself
yes.
is
yeah, it's a fantastic.
That's where John Lennon lived.
Yeah,
John Lennon.
Yeah. Oh, Yoko Ono yep. still lives there.
Oh, does she?
Mm-hmm. I have favorite places too, like where Grant's tomb is out beyond Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting spot, and the cloisters.
The cloisters are
yes.
fabulous.
John D. and Abby Rockefeller's.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's great. Oh.
So much to see and do.
Oh, I know. It's incredible. I love New York City. We'll be back talking about New York in just a few minutes. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Hi there, it's Pat McDonald. Welcome back. I'm here with Suzanne Butterfield, who is a tour guide for, oops, what is the name of
Custom
your group?
Custom and Tours more.
And More. And More. And that's the name of, it's part of the
that's
name?
It. It was Custom Tours.
Oh, that's cool. Custom Tours and More.
And then
and
with
more.
The new owner in 2017, another friend of mine.
Oh,
the,
good.
The first, the one who started it back 30 years ago is a good friend.
Oh, that's
from
great.
From Killington, yes.
Is that how you got involved?
Yes. Actually, I was substitute teaching in the year 2000, and one of the teachers, retired teachers, was a tour guide, and she told me all about it. And as it turned out, I knew the person who owned the company.
Oh,
and
nice.
Been doing that ever since. And then we changed hands in 2017.
You're a natural. You know that.
Well,
because you like people.
I like people.
And like me,
history.
You like to talk.
Yes. And I was in sales for years, and I was fortunate that the company, one of the two companies that I was with, would give you sales awards every year. And I got, my husband and I were able to go on two or three major trips every
nice.
Year. Switzerland, France, Italy, Spain, Brazil.
Great.
So I, from the other viewpoint of being a consumer of
right.
tours, I knew what I liked, I knew what I didn't like.
Right.
So when I get into the tour business as a guide, and I do sales and marketing for the company as well, I guess I knew the do's and don'ts and what people like, what they choose not to care for so much.
Well, if I ever go, Suzanne, it's all about the
oh.
food. I'm just telling you.
Okay. And the chocolate.
The chocolate. We were talking at the break time, as I, for those of you who know me, I love New York City. And I used to work there, and we would go there as often as we can. But we were talking about St. Patrick's Cathedral and some of the amazing cathedrals
yes.
and churches they have there. And have you brought tours to St.
Yes.
Pat's?
Oh, yes. That is always a highlight going yeah. into St. Patrick's Cathedral when we're at Rockefeller Center, you know, just go over to St.
Right.
Pat's. But people don't realize the largest cathedral in the world is the other end of Manhattan, and that is called St. John the Divine.
Right, right.
And it's Episcopal.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the times I was there, they had these scaffoldings everywhere in the church. I thought, what's going on? And they told me, they said, oh, Sting and the police are coming to perform.
At
Sting,
the cathedral?
At St. John the Divine. Well, they
all
need
right.
to do a lot of fundraising to keep everything together. And it is the world's largest cathedral.
Now,
people will give you an argument on it. They'll say no, you know, one in Europe or...
Well, that's great. Now, I've been there, and I never knew that, because
yeah,
that's a place to go to.
Yes.
And you were mentioning the cloisters, of course,
yes.
which is...
That's amazing. That,
isn't that amazing?
We can thank John D. Rockefeller Jr. and Abby for that, all the things that they brought from mm-hmm. Europe, the stone. And so,
and you also talked on your New York tour on unusual ethnic dining. Well, Little Italy and Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you want to have ethnic dining, New York's the place. Montreal's not too bad either.
No,
I might
my favorite in New York City, my favorite Italian restaurant is Carmine's.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes.
I
but
love
there's
this.
Two. There's one up in yeah. Times Square, and then there's the one
yeah,
downtown.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Little Italy itself, cannolis, good grief.
Oh, it's
Ferrara's,
great.
That's the place to go.
For dessert.
Anyway, so let's move on to Rhode Island. And again, there's a whole list of things, one of which, as Suzanne mentioned, was chocolate tasting. So what is that, Suzanne?
Well, of course, chocolate is popular, and I don't know if it has to do with the culinary that is operated in and around Newport and Providence, Rhode Island. But yes, if that's something that the client wants, we may put together a special arranged event where they would have chocolate at, say, the Breakers or one of those places. Maybe the in Newport, it could be the New York Yacht Club that was
nice.
Owned. Originally, the building was owned by the people that started Brown College, if you go way back into the 1800s. Now it's the York Yacht Club.
I was at the UN one time for a meeting,
mm-hmm.
and they had a chocolate fountain. So I had a guest with us at our company from Hokkaido, Japan, and Nori and I stood by the chocolate fountain the entire time.
Was that their first experience with chocolate?
Well, no. He just. I don't think he's ever seen a fountain before. So, they sort of asked us to move along at some point. But anyway, you mentioned the Breakers. It's mm-hmm. Vanderbilt Summer Cottage. Now, is that a restaurant or what is the Breakers? I don't know.
It was there. You've never been in the
no,
Breakers?
No, I have never been in.
There's mansion tours of Newport, and that
right.
is frequently one that people sign up for. Maybe they can't do maybe just one, and that'll be the one that they
mm-hmm.
that they choose, and we have a guided tour of that. And it was a cottage to them, and it's interesting that the Vanderbilts are the ones that are related to Shelburne Farm, Shelburne Museum, Electra Havemeyer Webb, and the Vanderbilt connection there.
Right. So it's their summer
family
cottage in quotes. Oh, I'm sure it's a little bigger than my house.
I can't even tell you how many rooms are in there, but it's amazing. I had one friend from Killington she got married there. She got married in the same church as John and Jackie Kennedy, and her reception was at Rosemont or something, one of those, not the Breakers, but some smaller.
Nice. We actually, Bruce and I went to Rhode Island one time, and we took the walk on the water by the mansions. There's a walk you can take.
Yes.
Seriously. And they had actors, one of whom was from Lost Nation Theater, in period outfits, sort of playing that they were the residents of the house, and it was a summer gig. And I thought, what fun is that?
Yep, these homes, a lot of that.
Homes are amazing.
And some of our people, if they're seniors and they – when I first started, we had World War II era people and Korea War vets. And now, you know, not so many of them are traveling. But those who are, you know, good can do something like that. We would give them maybe an option of either the walking tour or a drive-by on the bus.
Oh, nice. Well, that walking tour was – it was just like everything was perfect. The day, the water. I mean, it was – it was incredible.
It was unforgettable.
Still talking about it. So, and the next state is New Hampshire. And, of course, you have Franconia Notch. How sad that was.
The
old man on the mountain. Oh, it's because it's still everywhere that you see on symbols and
their
signs.
Number plates, yes. It's still there in our hearts and memories. And they do have the reflection. They've got the the profile.
You have down here, Chris. We take our motorcycle on the Kangamangas as often as we could, but you've got on Golden Pond Cruise.
Yes.
Is that the Golden Pond from the movie?
Yes.
Is it?
Yep. It's
cool.
It's Squam Lake, and they have a couple of pontoon boats, and they take you out. It's a nature thing. You get to see the loons. They take you all around, and of course you hope for the perfect day. But even if it isn't a perfect day, it's misty and raining, it's still a perfect day.
I didn't realize that was Squam Lake, because I know where that is. You also mentioned aerial tramway rides. Is that the cog rail by any chance?
Well, that wouldn't be an aerial tram. That would be –
of course,
rail.
Aerial tram is actually
in the
air. That
would go up Cannon Mountain.
Right.
And that holds, you know, 30, 40, 50 people.
Right.
It's been a couple of years since I've been on that tram, but that's spectacular, and they can have lunch at the top.
Nice.
But the cog now, they've got a couple of cars, and they're biomass or biodiesel is what they use.
Well, you know Tim Lewis?
Yes. Yes, sure.
Tim has done years of research.
I know Danny Gore.
Yes, you do. Everybody knows Danny.
That's my Danny Gore jokes.
Tim grew up. His father worked in the summertime at the cog rail, and he's called a cog kid, and he's got all these books about people that worked there in the summer, and he's got these amazing pictures of the whole transition of the cog rail being built, and it's asked him.
Well, that goes back quite a way. I did that when I was a kid. And my good friend George Trask worked there. He's from Randolph, and now his son, George Trask.
Well, I'll have to ask Tim.
He must be
in Tim's books
because
he's got about four or five thick books of people that worked, that were cog kids.
People say, you know everybody in all of New England. Well, it's because we're such a small state and such a small area, you do, especially if you travel.
The lesson is always speak nicely about everybody.
That's
because
you never know.
That
cog railway and getting off at the top at the observation place. It's just amazing. I mean, they have winds that are over 100 miles an hour. It's just a...
Really?
Yeah. And I've been there on a couple of those days.
Mess your hair up. And you also have Lake Winnipesaukee, which is just beautiful.
It is. And one of my favorite things to do once a year is to go out on Lake Winnipesaukee for their dinner cruise.
In Lake Champlain. Yeah, I love that. So next, moving on, I want to get through these, especially Maine, since I summer in Maine. In Massachusetts, I have never been to Salem. Isn't that embarrassing?
Yes.
What is
it's just north of Boston.
Well, I know. I just never think of it. I go to Maine, and there we are.
Well,
and Canada. We do Canada.
Well, you should. When you go to Salem, ask for my friend Mary, who runs the Salem Witch Museum.
Oh, no
so
kidding.
So she and everybody down in Salem has had a real busy week. But when I was a kid growing up in Boston, to me, Salem was just where the State Teachers College was. One of them was in Salem. I didn't really think of the tourism aspect. Of course, I knew my history, and I knew all those people that were killed, though, over 200 of them, that, you know, the witch thing that they did that was an embarrassment.
What do you see in Salem? What's the old houses? And
there's no reenactment of...
No, thank God for that.
Yes, thank goodness for that. there's just a lot, so much of our history.
Right.
And I'm interested in the Puritans and the Pilgrims and all of that being from the South Shore and the Cape. And my own relatives that came over with the Puritans in the Mass Bay Colony. Roger Williams took those Quaker relatives of mine and took them to Rhode Island for freedom of religion because they didn't particularly care for what the Puritans were telling them to do. So there's so much history around, other than just the Revolutionary War.
That's great. I should really go there. It's embarrassing. But you obviously have lobster bakes now, on the beach.
On the Cape, yes.
That's cool.
I grew up on the Cape down in Truro, and the other side of Pilgrim Lake is Race Point, and that's where we're apt to have lobster bakes and doom buggy rides for our clients that want something like. Not everybody would want maybe to go on doom buggy rides.
Really? And no, don't tell me they say no to lobster bakes.
Well, we have to have steak, too, for the ones that don't do crustaceans.
Well, that's a luxury, steak and lobster. There you go.
They read that back in the old days, the prisoners were fed lobster.
Oh, really? It was a throwaway meat once.
It was
once.
A throwaway thing.
It's sort of like flank steak growing up was the throwaway meat. Now you can't afford it. Isn't it amazing?
So true.
We've been going through all of the New England states, and we're going to hit my favorite state, Maine, because we summer there. And everything on this list, every other thing's got the word lobster in it, Suzanne, so you've got me sold. Lighthouses and wildlife nature cruises, they're all over Maine.
All over. There's so much coastline. I mentioned that New Hampshire has 18 miles. Well, Maine has many, many, many times that.
Right. It's beautiful, isn't it?
It's spectacular.
And each one's got a story, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I used to do the schooner cruises out of Camden. That was the thing that my girlfriend from Rochester, New York, and I would do. We'd get a bunch of friends together. We'd meet in Camden, go out on the schooners. Our way was paid because we were sort of marketing it and getting people to sign up. So we would see the whales.
That's great. You've been doing this a long time.
Well, sort of as an amateur. You know, when you live in one state and you're from another, anyone who comes to visit you, you're sort of, if you're interested, play amateur tour guide.
Right.
So
I've
done that.
That's great. So you have a list here, which I need to know about.
Okay.
You have moose safari. Where do you go to find moose?
The western part of Maine, up around the ski areas.
Right.
And they are there.
Yes.
And they pretty much, without using the word money back guarantee, you're pretty much guaranteed to see
What's
a moose.
What's the name of the town up there?
Kingfield?
Yes, and there's Rockport? Can't remember.
Oh, that's on the coast.
Oh, Rockport, on the coast.
Rockland and Rockport are on the coast.
Okay, well, there's a place up where the ski lodge that we used to go up there, and you'd see moose all the time.
Yes.
And I knew the Motor Vehicle Commissioner of Maine, and he called me one time knowing I was over there on our motorcycles. He said, do not go out before 10 o'clock in the morning because you'll hit one.
Yeah, that's about right.
Because the black flies were so bad, they were forcing the moose out on
the
roads. Mm-hmm. And sadly, you could see where the moose and the cars hit early. It was very sad.
It is sad. Well, up around Sunday River ski area and you know, those places, you really are pretty much guaranteed. The people that live there and that are in the tour business and the hotel business, well, they know to tell you what they told you.
Right.
You see them first thing in the morning and later in the day.
And so they are magnificent creatures, seriously.
Well, they're huge.
Yeah.
They don't
have natural enemies, do they? They're kind of fearless.
Deer ticks.
Oh, well, that's true. Bleed them to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they get the spruce budworm, too. But a fun trip that we might build into somebody's itinerary is one of the brewery tours where they would take you on like a driving tour with some of their microbrew to see moose.
Oh, cool.
So that would be probably later in the afternoon as opposed to first thing in the morning.
Yeah, right, exactly. Beer in the morning, maybe not so good. Where do the carriage rides take place?
Oh, my favorite is Mount Desert Island, Cadillac Mountain.
Oh, Cadillac Mountain,
over Frenchman's Bay, yes. And it is a national park, so you would need a receptive tour operator that knows that their client just can't come up with their motor coach without getting a permit ahead of time. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Maine is just beautiful.
Yes.
And we are so big on lobster and everything else that's fish.
I even went one time to Poland Spring.
Oh, yes.
And that was an old, you know, like an old sanctuary, and the spring is still there, of course. We had like a little convention there. It was awesome.
I bet it was nice because it was a beautiful grounds there.
The architecture.
When we were coming from the west to the east, we went right through Poland. Yeah. That's great.
There's a casino up there too in Oxford, Maine.
I didn't know that. There's a couple. And of course, L.L. Bean, which is open 24/7.
Well, everyone loves Freeport. Yep. And they now have another store that has like seconds in there. So you've got the main store that used to be open 24 hours a day.
Right.
And then just down the hill.
Did COVID stop the 24-hour thing?
It might have cut it back, but I don't think they ever closed.
Oh, do they? Because every place you go in Maine and all these, there's
everywhere.
People are just, they don't have enough staff.
No, and it's hard.
It's really scary.
It's really difficult for people coming to visit Vermont and New England. It really helps to have a receptive who can set up the all-important attractions and meals. Because if you come on your own... Back in the old days, there used to be the bus driver would come with 45 people.
Right.
And maybe it was a couple of senior centers combined where they had a couple of group leaders, but it wasn't their job. They really need someone who can set everything up for them, whether it's New York City or Maine or Vermont, Canada.
That's great. And let's talk a little bit about Canada because we only have a few minutes left, but you do Montreal, Ottawa, Quebec, and where is – you had one that I couldn't pronounce.
Tadoussac. Yes.
And let's just talk about that first, because I think a lot of us know Montreal. You've got whale watching, of course, and fjord.
Yes, there's a fjord up there. Somebody could actually start in Lake Champlain, go up north through the Richelieu River, out into the St. Lawrence River, out into the St. Lawrence Seaway, and all along between Montreal and Quebec City. There's so much to see and do. You can do it by motor coach.
Really? That must be beautiful up there.
Oh, it's fabulous. That's and Quebec great. City, Montreal, you feel like you're in France.
Right.
Mount Royal. And Quebec City, you feel like you're in France. And it was New France until the English came in and, you know, they didn't take Quebec province.
And is the language an issue in Quebec?
It can be. Some of the shops up there, the last time I was there, they really didn't. They didn't speak English, and we can't be the ugly American. We can't be the person that says, get me someone who speaks English. So I would try. I would, you know, speak French to them because I had it in school a little bit. And then they're more willing to help you. But
that's great.
But Quebec City, I would recommend, you know, the Chateau Frontenac going up there, the Plains of Abraham, the fortress where General Wolfe was killed after he took Louisbourg and Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, and headed west.
That's great.
So much history.
They have a marine mammal interpretation center.
They do.
That must be fabulous.
Yes, they have all the, you know, seals and sea lions and whales and
that's great.
You name it.
And of course, puffins. You've got down watching the changing of the guard. That's very special. Have you been to a parliament up there?
Actually, I have. I've been to the one in Ottawa, and I had a relative that was lieutenant governor of Ontario.
Oh, wonderful.
My cousin's husband. So I almost had a chance to meet the Queen when they were there in 1959.
Nice.
So always been interested in that sort of thing, and that is something that we could definitely set up for tourism. They did come to a screaming halt when COVID hit, as far as changing of the
guard. I was up at Montreal at their legislature, and they yell at each other. They don't do what we do here in Montpelier.
Not as polite, no?
Not as polite. They throw things at each other. And the woman I was visiting was part of the parliament. And she looked up at me and she winked. And because I was like a deer in headlight watching these people. I'm like, what is this? And then she winked and I went, oh, it's
what
they
do. Is it for
show? Yeah.
It doesn't sound civil.
But it is. I mean, it is and it isn't. When it's over, everybody's laughing and joking and leaving.
Oh, good.
Because when she winked at me, I went, oh, okay, it's all right. Because I thought, what is going on here?
Well, a lot of people think that Ottawa always was the capital of Canada, but it wasn't. It was Kingston. Kingston, Ontario was the first capital. One of my ancestors, John Alexander MacDonald.
Nice name.
You're a MacDonald.
I'm a MacDonald, right.
I'm a MacDonald. Yeah. And he was the first premier back in the 1800s.
Cool. So what does the museum in Ottawa, I saw Museum of Civilization, what is that?
I was surprised when I saw it. It's a very modern building, and we spent hours in there. This was on a FAM tour, so I got to be with other tour operators, and you know, it was jaw-dropping. Everything you can imagine is in there.
That's great. I would actually like to see that.
It's worth a trip.
Yeah, I bet it is.
And then
it's
see great. Everything else while you're there.
That's
Make
great.
Sure you do Old Montreal, too.
Oh, I love Old Montreal. That's great. We have friends who live in Fredericton, and I go to visit up in Canada quite often.
Good.
And he can speak French and English, so wherever we go with my brother by another mother, he'll get us through and always respectful that they are very dedicated to their history and their
and now we can get up there, the border's open, so
yes, exactly.
That.
Yeah, that was sad for a while.
It was very sad.
Yeah. So you said you go to opera in New York. The opera in Montreal is beautiful. The Place d'Homme. That's
Never
worth
did
a trip.
That.
It's worth it. Anyway, we're about ready to close the show. I can't thank you enough, Suzanne. Check out the website and ask for Suzanne when you're touring around.
Thank you. Well, this is November 1, and what a perfect way to wrap up our Fall Foliage tour season now that October has gone by, and it was a great season. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome. It was we did the tour up the Northeast Kingdom to see all the foliage. It was just amazing this year. Thank you very much, Suzanne Butterfield from Custom Tours and More.
Thank you.
I love it. Thanks all. We'll see you next Tuesday. Bye. Pat McDonald from WDEV.